Hey team, you're about to experience my interview with Andres Bedoya of Umari. He is the co-founder and CEO of Umari, and Umari is an end-to-end digital B2B trade platform for LATAM. They handle everything end-to-end. They handle design, manufacturing, and logistics for sourcing products from all across the Latin American market. They have a deep specialization in particular in Mexico and Peru and several other LATAM countries. We had a fantastic conversation about what it's like to build an end-to-end trade platform that runs across countries and languages and all sorts of trading regulations in all these different parts of the world. We really dug deep into what it's taking to build this very, very impressive platform. Apologies for some of the technical difficulties we had with some of the audio. The audio on his end was a little bit challenging. We had some difficulty syncing up our different audio tracks, but hopefully that will not distract you from the fantastic conversation that we had. Welcome to B2B Commerce Corner. Commerce Corner is a sub-series of the E-Commerce Edge podcast discussing all things B2B commerce through the lens of agencies, consultants, merchants, and more. Enjoy. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the pod. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome Andres Bedoya from Umari to the pod. Welcome, Andres.
Jason, thank you for having me.
My absolute pleasure. And we were talking about off air that you are my second only, in 340 episodes, you are my second only Mexican guest, and you are based in Mexico City, the beautiful city of CDMX. So I'm super stoked to have you along for the ride today.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. Yeah, I'm impressed that I'm only the second Mexican guest.
Yeah, look, and I got to change that. I got to work on my Mexican game. Seeing as how I now live in Puebla, only 2 hours drive from you in Mexico City, I've got to work on my Mexican game. That is for sure. But look, mate, I love this country. I'm having so much fun here. Been here just over a year now. Spent the first year in 2023 traveling all around this mighty country, orientating myself, my wife and I with our dog, traveling around the country. I'm trying to absorb as much of the culture and the food and the weather and just the experience that is Mexico. I tell you, it is slightly overwhelming. And coming from a quiet country like New Zealand, I had to, first of all, remind myself of how much noise there is in this country of all types. And I had to just reorientate myself to the festive nature. It's a festive culture. Like the Mexican culture, that is the term I would give it. It is a festive culture. And Mexicans will celebrate absolutely anything or nothing at all. And Mexicans know how to have fun.
I think we do. And that's kind of been my obsession. I think Mexico is very particular. And I love that it's all about the music and the sounds and the food and the smells. And it is, as you said, it is very overwhelming. I remember when I first moved to China, some of my students or my friends would say, oh, China's a bit overwhelming. And I'm like, leave the overwhelming part to the like North Europeans or to the Kiwis. But like for us Mexicans, like we're used to the sounds and the smells and the parties and the colors and the culture and the history and the movement and the screaming on the street and not knowing if they're angry, if they're fighting, or if they love each other. That's how we grew up. And I love that about Mexico.
I do. It's so funny that you say that, whether people are fighting or not. I remember when we were staying in our first Airbnb in Coyoacan in CDMX. And I remember when the trucks came by announcing that they were there to buy or pick up furniture. When they talk about the camas and they talk about the mesas and they talk about, and they've got this recording playing and it's on the top of their truck and it's on a massive speaker on the top of their truck. And they're going around and they buy old furniture or pick up or collect old furniture. And then they'll fix it up and resell it. In every major town and city in Mexico, they have this and it's the same recording. They all use the same recording. I don't know how this gets around Mexico. And it's the same with the people that bring around the tamales and all that stuff with the food carts. They also all use the same recording and it's the same girl. No, I don't know how this gets
Jason,
across the whole
country.
You
gotta get her in the podcast.
Wow. Is this girl like a famous Mexican girl that does all these recordings that it's the same recording Mexico-wide?
She was not when she made the recording. She originally made the recording for her dad, who was buying old furniture. but now she's become the voice of buying anything that's old and can be fixed and resold. And it is the same recording used all across Mexico. And so now she's been interviewed, like spin on the news 1,000 times. So you should definitely reach out.
That is freaking amazing. And I remember the first time we heard this, and it was really early in the morning. It was like, I don't know, the first time I heard this, it was like 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning or something like that. And my wife woke me up and she said, what's going on? And we thought it was a demonstration. We thought, because I couldn't understand, because it was quite muffled. I couldn't understand what was being said. And we thought it was a political demonstration happening in the street. That's what we thought it was, because it was so loud and it was so like rapid fire. It sounded like some kind of political demonstration. That's what we thought it was.
My wife thought it was a bomb alarm. When we first moved, I mean, my wife is German. She was born in Kazakhstan. We met in Shanghai. She's been all over. She's seen some stuff. But when she first heard, se compra colchones, she thought it was a bomb alarm.
it's the same. And then when the first time I heard the food carts coming through town with, again, I think it's the same girl that has done that food cart recording, and it's now all over Mexico. I think these things, I tell you, they're so culturally entrenched. And then when you hear the gas trucks coming around with their recordings. And so you start to get to understand what all these different, in the United States, you might have ice cream trucks or something like that with the ice cream man that comes around with the song playing and then it stops and then they announce the ice cream man or whatever. So you maybe know that if you're from an English speaking country, you've probably seen or heard of the ice cream man before. But in Mexico, that all these distinct recordings for all these different distinct businesses, it's hilarious, but it's such an ingrained part of the culture that I absolutely love it.
It is. No, it is amazing. I love being back in Mexico. It's also like a lot has changed, but a lot of things just always stay the same. And I love that about it.
And what also seems to have stayed the same over the years, and I used to come to Mexico when I was in my late teens, because I grew up in Southern California, so I grew up very close to the border. And so I would come down and we'd come down through Tijuana and we'd come down the coast and we'd come down through Ensenada, as the gringos on the West Coast always do. And we'd have a great time. We'd eat great food. We'd drink great beer. We'd enjoy the sunshine and the beaches and just everything. But one thing that struck me from the time I was extremely young, and this ties in, I think, to the conversation I'd love to have with you today, is that Mexico is probably, in my experience, and I have traveled, man, I've traveled quite a bit around this world. It is one of the most entrepreneurial countries I have ever encountered. It is just the amount of street vendors, the amount of shops, small shops on every street corner, the amount of abuelitas making tortillas, the concept. It's not even considered, I don't even think they consider themselves entrepreneurs. They just have small family businesses. And this is absolutely the norm in Mexico. So it is just massively entrepreneurial. It feels like it's part of the fiber of any Mexicano's being.
I think it is. I think you said it before we started, we got on the air, but you talked about the lack of a safety net. And I think that the lack of a safety net for Mexicans just forces us to look for business anywhere. And so you'll have anyone will create a business out of anything. It doesn't matter what their skill is or what their access is to some sort of product or activity, or you'll always make a business out of it. I think people, because we lack a safety net, that would allow us to know that it doesn't matter what happens, we'll always have housing or access to food or access to health services. I feel like we always feel like we need to be coming up with ways to make money. And it doesn't matter if that's because you have a special skill or because you have access to a specific product because of where you're from, but you'll take that into account and you'll make a business out of it. And I love that because every time I'm traveling, like for example, in China, I lived in China for 10 years, so I make a lot of references to China, but you walk for a couple of hours, like walking off steps in a mountain for a couple of hours until you reach a temple. And every single time I reach the top of the temple, I'd be like, if this were Mexico, someone would be selling beers up here. Someone would be selling super cold beers right now. And so you would
tacos, eat tamales.
Yes. Tacos, tamales, amelotes. And so you go up to the top of the mountain. I'm just waiting. Like, where is where's all the people selling me stuff? I just walked 2 hours up this mountain and I want a cold beer. And nothing will they'll be selling just a cold beer. Do you go to some place and then just have beers there in the shop and they're like warm? Someone will be creating micheladas out of it. They'll be putting ice and they'll be putting, you know,
camarones.
Yeah, I love it. We do. I think we are an entrepreneurial country. I think the spirit of Mexicans has always been to work hard and create something that's different and new. And I like that about it. And that's why every single time I went abroad, every single time I traveled, I always wonder if we are like this, if we are people of business, if we are people of entrepreneurship, what's happened? Why are we doing better? And so it's been something that's in my mind my whole life growing up. And so I've obsessed with trying to study what other countries have done and why it's worked for some others and hasn't for some in Latin America, like Mexico.
That seems like how Umari came into being. And maybe you can tell us what Umari is. I'll take a stab at it. Because it's even for me, who's a digital native, it's a little hard for me to fully appreciate exactly what the Umari platform is and does and can be. I almost feel like it's a little bit of a partner manufacturing platform, partly a distribution and logistics platform, and part marketplace, all for B2B. And it's all focused on the fashion world. But I don't fully like that. That's my initial take on it. When I've been to the website, I've been doing some research on the platform. But please tell me what Umari is and what you built it to become.
Sure, 100%. I think you're spot on. But yes, let me try to, I think it's better if I try to explain why it came to be. And I did move to China because I wanted to understand what China did to lift 700 million people out of poverty in 20 years from 1990 to 2010. And and my thesis at university, when I was doing my master's degree, was the impact of digital platforms in the process of diversification of export markets for China and how that impacted their ability to alleviate poverty. And so I obviously started studying a lot what had happened in Alibaba.com. If you look a little bit at what was happening with Alibaba.com came to be, that was 1919. So China was preparing to go into the World Trade Organization. China comes into the WTO in 2001, and Alibaba becomes de facto. For anyone that was trying to understand what China was able to do, Alibaba was this window that allowed the world to see what China was able to manufacture. And so I started studying how when a digital platform allows a country to show the world what it can do, it allows for that country to diversify their export markets. When you diversify your export markets, you increase your prices, which give you better margins, which allow you to invest in research and development, which allow you to pay better salaries, which allow you to create products with added value. And that creates kind of this snowball of economic development and social growth, right? In the manufacturing and producing communities in China. And to me, that was fascinating. And so I was trying to understand how and why that hadn't happened in Mexico. Mexico is the 12th largest exporter in the world. And I was trying to understand what happened. In the 80s, mid-80s, Mexico was exporting more than China. And so I wanted to understand what had happened. And I ended up working at Alibaba. And I spent a lot of time at Alibaba. So I worked in a couple of Alibaba projects while I was in China. But then I came to Mexico leading global initiatives for Alibaba Group, and then ultimately led Alibaba.com for the region for the past 4 years. And for me, it made a lot of sense. I was like, okay, so here you have the largest B2B trade platform in the world. 30% of its buyers are American. And these Americans have been through a lot. These American businesses have been through a lot in the past 5 years, 6 years, starting from the trade war, COVID and its effects on the logistics and transportation around the world, and the delay in production, then there's a crazy increase in the transportation prices, logistics prices, minimum order quantities went up. And so a lot of the buyers in Alibaba.com, they were asking for alternatives. They were saying, hey, maybe I cannot depend on having all of my suppliers in Asia, and maybe I need to explore suppliers in my region. And so for me, it made a lot of sense. I was like, okay, that's perfect. So everything that I've been studying my whole life, this makes sense right now. I'm going to move to Mexico and I'm going to get every single factory in Mexico into Alibaba.com, and they will magically just start selling to the world. And then, mind you, I hadn't been in Mexico for a long time. And so when I came back to Mexico, I realized something. I realized that the industrial Mexico had a delay of 25 years in the professionalization and digitization of its commercial and export offer. And when we see that Mexico is the 12th largest exporter in the world, I started realizing that producers and manufacturers actually didn't export anything. The products were cataloged as exports because they were going to leave Mexico. But that doesn't mean that it's them selling it to the rest of the world. It's someone else. It's what we call a coyote, a middleman, an abusive middleman that takes those products and takes them to the world. But it's not actually the Mexican entrepreneur, the Mexican businessman, the one that's moving those products. And the value in the exports is in the service. That's where you get the increased margins that allow you to grow. And so I realized that Mexico had never even started the process. And that's why we never created this snowball of economic development and growth. And I realized that we just couldn't use a platform that was created in 1999 to bring Chinese factories into the world trade market. We couldn't use it 25 years later to try to bring Latin American companies into the same system. We needed something that understood the opportunities and the shortcomings of Mexican companies. And so that's why I left Alibaba in December 2022 to create a platform that would solve three basic problems. Number one was giving the right information to the buyers about who was the best factory to produce what they want. Number two, being able to help them quote logistics. So we would take care of logistics and transportation in order to be able to quote American companies with DDP prices. So I wanted it to be just as easy as it is to do it with China. So you don't need to know what's going to happen. You need to know about exports, customs clearance, about the certificate of origin. I'll take care of everything. I leave
bill of lading, all that rubbish. FBO,
I'll take care of everything. And then finally, I'll take care of safe transaction for you, because I know that with Chinese, it's taking you 25 years for you to trust them. And now they have 15 different ways for you to pay them. And if you try to move your manufacturing to Latin America, you would still have to, there's only one choice, which is a transfer. And so we needed to fix those three things. And that's why we started building Yumari. We went out, we raised a round of VC money, and we started building what we expect to be the first cross-border B2B digital platform for Latin American suppliers. Now, yes, right now, we are focusing on one vertical. And that's why you're focusing on fashion. And that's something that didn't happen from the beginning, because me coming from Alibaba, my expertise is moving products. So I was like, we can do anything. And so I was like, we were sourcing, when we first opened, we raised money January to June last year. We had an MVP out in August, and I said, we can do anything. So I was sourcing potassium chloride in the morning and sugar in the afternoon and avocado oil at night and clothes at midnight. And I was going nuts. And so once we understood and realized and proved that there was a high intent for businesses in North America to relocate supply chains into Latin America or to include Latin American suppliers into their supplier roster, we're like, okay, now it's time for us to get organized. And so we are opening by verticals. The first vertical we've been exploring is apparel and fashion, where we are helping all those brands in the U.S. that want to relocate their manufacturing to Latin America. We help them set it up and create the whole supply chain. But once we are ready with that, we will jump onto home and decor, beauty and healthcare, food and beverage, school and office supplies. So we plan to be the first horizontal multi-category platform in the region.
Super excited. We can think of you as an Alibaba for LATAM, and starting obviously with the focus being Mexico to begin with. And I'm super excited about this because I have, as I've traveled around this country, I have been shocked at the lack of digitalization of Mexico. And what I've been shocked further by is the absolute and utter dominance of three major online players in this country around retail, that being Amazon, that being Mercado Libre, and that being Coppel. And when we look at those three, they dominate online sales in this country. There's not a lot of D2C happening in this country. There's not a lot of B2C happening in this country from an e-commerce perspective. I think it has to do with regulations. I think it has to do with taxes. I think it has to do with the cost of cross-border trade into and out of Mexico. But I absolutely love the idea that Mexico is now becoming a manufacturer to the world, not just to the United States, but to the world. And what I saw, even in the last year of being here, is that I saw a lot of companies, the talk was, a lot of companies started to realize, especially American brands, that this over-reliance on China was going to ultimately kill them as a business. And they realized that they got burnt so badly during COVID and how badly China fumbled the COVID ball and how they basically turned it into a giant prison for 3 years in China and how people couldn't get goods in or out of China. They did, but it was a struggle and it was very expensive. And there was fits and starts around manufacturing, starting back up and then shutting back down and starting back up and shutting back down. This concept of just in time for American brands, just-in-time manufacturing and just-in-time logistics, there was zero flex and zero. We could think of the supply chain as being pretty much completely rigid in that environment, whether it be B2B transactions happening from China to the United States for distribution from within the US, or literally door-to-door manufacturers manufacturing China and shipping to end customers directly in the USA. China had completely built their entire infrastructure around the ability to do that. So they could move individual parcels or they could move cartons, pallets, and containers door to door. And whether that be door to individual consumer door or manufacturing door to warehouse door overseas, they had built up their logistics prowess to be able to handle that. Now that's a phenomenal, when we think about e-commerce, when we think about digital commerce, it is basically logistics with a user-friendly web front end put on it. That's basically what e-commerce is. It's a logistics business. And when we think about what happened during COVID and how many businesses in the United States went out of business because they could not get their goods out of China, all of a sudden people started to realize maybe this rigid supply chain, maybe this just-in-time supply chain isn't going to work for us forever. Maybe it was good for its time, but we now need to have flex. Now we need to either nearshore, we need to dual shore, we need to have some flex built into the supply chain. And obviously, Mexico was always going to be a natural bedfellow for American companies because it's just across the border. Mexico has massive access to both natural and human resources and capital. And it's a very advanced country in almost all the respects that matter. Mexico is advanced enough to be able to be a supply chain partner and a production partner to United States brands. And it makes sense to me. My question that would fall off the back of these observations, and I agree with you on everything you said, what impact does that have on the peso? Because what we've seen is the emergence of the super peso because of this nearshoring that has started to happen. The demand for the peso has gone through the absolute roof. And when Tesla starts talking about creating a gigafactory here, when I was on the bus between Mexico City and Querétaro, which is the first city we went to after CDMX, and we drove past the Tremec factory, and it was the size of 5 football fields. When we think of Querétaro and we think of the aerospace manufacturing that happens there, when we think of Puebla, where I live, and the biggest VW and the biggest Audi factory outside of Germany are located in Puebla, this is all great for Mexico. But at some point, that demand for the peso, because of all the capital flooding into Mexico to build out this manufacturing capacity, it's pushing up the price of these exports. So at what point does it become a downside versus an upside to have a strong peso?
It's always a downside for exports. I mean, from the beginning, I remember when we started making the first simulations for product movement, we started doing it with like 19 pesos per dollar. And we went down to 17.60 at some point last year.
Now it's under 16 peso. As of today.
16.93,
right, I think, now? Today. Yeah.
It always affects 100% the competitivity of the exports for Mexico. And I do think that it is going to self-regulate. If you see, and this is something that I criticize a lot when people speak about all of the benefits of the attraction of foreign direct investment, because when I think foreign direct investment, I can't help to think of the moment and when the world was not talking about nearshoring, it was talking about offshoring. And when the big winner of that was China and how they handled it and how they said, that sounds great that you are coming to Mexico. It sounds great, Charles Tesla, that you want to put a gigafactory in Mexico. It sounds great, Amazon, that you're setting up your whole cloud infrastructure in Querétaro. But if this were China, 15, 20 years ago, they would have said only one tiny thing. When you want to invest in China, you come in with a Chinese partner at 51%. Also, you have 3 years to integrate 60% of your suppliers with local manufacturers. Oh, also another thing, I need you to hire 50% of your directors have to be Mexican. Other things you need to do on talent training in high-skilled labor, and you need to do technology transfer and knowledge transfer. And so I love it when we talk about the opportunity for Mexico to receive investment because of the opportunity it represents, but I would love it if we could be talking also about how that investment that we're attracting into our country is also creating the ability for our local businesses to jump the growth or the learning curve of industrialization and can leapfrog into a time where Latin Mexican companies are growing just as fast as the companies that are coming to invest in us. So yeah, so I criticize a lot the fact that we see this investment, so we hear about this investment as if they were inherently good, but we never stop to think about job creation or technology transfer, which should be the most important thing when we're talking about charge of larger investment. So to me, I'll always trump the importance of pushing for the competitivity of exports, because I have seen what exports can do for poverty alleviation in the most underserved areas of society.
Hey team, I have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you, and now back to your listening. Wow, it sounds like you're being super thoughtful about it, and hopefully you have some pull somewhere in the Mexican government where you can say, hey, look, we can take a page out of China's book here, but we can't just take the one page. In other words, we can't just recognize the opportunity like China did. We have to understand the downstream impacts like China did, and maybe not just take the opportunity page out of their book, but also take into account some of the road mapping of how we want this to change over time in our communities, because it can have such a disruptive effect, right? If we're talking some of these smaller manufacturers, some of these smaller brands, they're starting, everybody's happy about the super peso until they're not, right? Everybody, I think in general, like I'm in favor of a stronger peso. I think if you're a productive country, you have natural and human capital. I think Mexico has been incredibly smart on their immigration policy. I think they've been one of the smartest in the world around immigration policy. I think they were one of the smartest in the world around their COVID policy. No country is perfect and no government is perfect. So I'm not saying Mexico is perfect, but I'm saying that they've had to navigate some very complex issues over the last 5 or 6 years in particular. And they've done a pretty damn good job when we compare them to the rest of the world. And it's my hope and my expectation that they'll be able to navigate these dramatic changes that have been brought about, structural changes in secular changes in many respects to the Mexican economy, because of this nearshoring and dual shoring phenomenon that have driven like the highest demand ever for goods coming out of Mexico is happening right now.
It is. I always say it. I say this is, I start my conference by saying this is the best opportunity for a lot of people to become very rich in Mexico, except for Mexicans. It catches people's attention. But no, it is true. I do see that this is the most competitive time that Mexico has had in the past 40 years to not only participate, but to lead the world trade markets. And I really feel like it's the best opportunity we have right now, but we need to be smart about it. It's just not going to happen just like that. There needs to be public policy in place that allows for this to actually spread down to the people that need it most.
And how do we think about, let's think about some of the structural components of the Mexican economy, the way that the regulations work here, the way the business permits here work, the way the manufacturing permission works here, the way that, you know, Mexico is so unregulated in so many ways, but then it's so regulated in many other ways. Like I love the amount of freedom that we have in Mexico. There's not, you're not going to have noise control come into your house late at night if you're having a party late at night. It's very unlikely you're going to get pulled over for speeding on the highway unless you're doing something. I love the live and let live attitude that prevails in Mexico. That's one of the most attractive things about Mexico to me, is that people just let you live your life the way that you see fit, as long as you're not hurting somebody else. They just let you live your life. But then we have, on the flip side, we have a certain amount of governmental bureaucracy. We have a certain amount of governmental red tape. We have a certain amount of impact from the cartels and the fact that they are so heavily embedded. They don't just deal with the drugs. They deal with so many other aspects of business in this country, and they rule so many markets, and they are trying to legitimize in many respects what they do. And so they have their finger in lots of different pies in this country, from manufacturing to government and everywhere in between. So when you start to think about what would need to change structurally in this country to allow and help facilitate the growth of your business and to help grease the wheels, the export wheels of Mexico, to make it easier to get goods out of this country into other countries, what do you think needs to happen to make that more seamless?
I feel like one of the things, again, because when I was in Alibaba, I met a lot of founders that were trying to build the Alibaba of Latin America. And I think that they made a common mistake, which was they spent all of their money and time trying to digitize the export offer of as many factories as they could. And some of them try to do it with the help of the government. Some of them try to do it through the chambers of commerce. Some of them. But as you can see in Mexico, people are out to do business. And it's not very easy to try to organize them before the business is there. It always brings me back to, there's a chicken and egg problem in Mexico and Latin America, where you go, why isn't there enough business? And you'd answer, because there's no infrastructure. You ask, why is there no infrastructure? Because there's not enough business to justify it. And I always say, of course, public policy and investment in infrastructure is the first thing that needs to happen. I think Mexico needs a federal office for regulation of attraction for investment and an office for promotion of trade. We used that for Mexico. That's where I started my career, actually. But right now, there's no federal agency for promotion of trade and attraction of foreign direct investment. So
wow. That kind of blows my mind.
It doesn't make any sense. It does not make any sense. So I'm always pushing for the creation of an agency. Again, it's a promotion trade agency. Because that allows for business to happen. And once you have business, so what we do, for example, in Yumari, is my client is not the exporter. So I don't tell the factory, I'm going to help you sell. My client is a global business that has a supply chain problem. And so I tell them, I'm going to fix your problem with whatever company is willing to solve that problem for you. So I'm going to turn around and go to my factories in Mexico and go, who's ready to do this? I need this to be done in this amount of time, in this rate, in this fashion. I want this to cost this much. And when you have that opportunity, that's when Mexican businesses are ready to take the opportunity and actually deliver. And
figure it out in a way,
that,
right?
Yeah, that's what we do. But that's what allowed us to start transacting 3 months after we raised our round. So we became cash flow positive 3 months later, and we're growing. We're like doubling our GMV every month since we started transacting. Actually, it's because we've taken it. We understand how Mexican factories work, because I've been in Mexican factories my whole life, and we know that they just needed the opportunity to be able to participate in this supply chain. And that's what they weren't getting before.
Essentially, it sounds like you're a broker, but you've digitized in such a way that you're effectively a B2B marketplace. But it's on an RFQ basis to a degree, where you have a brand that's overseas. Look, we need to do this thing. We need to have this garment manufactured at scale. Here's our designs, whatever it is. Or maybe we even need a design and manufacturing partner. So we're going to partner with you to do the designs and the material selection and all that sort of stuff. And then we're going to work with you to actually do the manufacturing at scale. And so it feels like you're becoming the middleman, the middle woman, so to speak. And so you are the liaison between the buyer and the seller, the brand and the manufacturer. And so you're creating the connection. You are creating the connection where the overseas buyer or the overseas brand would have no idea where to start to look for a manufacturing partner in Mexico because they're not based here, they don't have boots on the ground, etc. And vice versa. The manufacturers in Mexico would have no idea where to find customers for their goods or to be able to even communicate with those customers that they can make almost anything that they want. They just need to know what the specs are, and then they can go away and they can source those materials, make those materials, and then manufacture to order. So it feels almost like you're creating a contract manufacturing environment within Mexico where you're the super connector. You're connecting the brands with the manufacturers.
Yeah, and even a bit more than that, because we're not only the middleman, we are the exporter of record. We do the customs clearance. We are the importer of record in the U.S. And we are, like, there are brands in the U.S. that we are doing product development. So they come in with a sketch, a tech bag, a link, a physical sample of the product. And we turn that into a spec, a sheet, or a tech bag that can be shared with our manufacturing facilities. We select who the manufacturing facility will be. Exactly. We select who the manufacturing facility will be depending on the price point, the lead time, the production quantity, the route of export. So we'll do quality control. We'll do our factory audit. We'll do production. We'll do exports, customs clearance, imports, and fulfillment to our end consumer in the U.S. So we'll send it over to a warehouse in Monterrey and do cross-border B2C with the minimis directly to the end consumer in the U.S. So my brands in the U.S. don't even have to, it's not about them having a warehouse in LA where their products go out of, which is super expensive and quite complicated, to be honest. They don't even have to see their products. We make sure that everything happens. And if there's any problems, they're an hour and a half away from their factory. They hop on a plane, they're an hour and a half, they're in the same time zone. We're speaking the same language. And yeah, what they really love is that, imagine if you were doing, like, you're a brand and you had 20 different products. You probably were talking to 7 different factories in China. So you had your WeChat and your WhatsApp and your email packed with quotes and conversations. And you didn't know where each one of those factories was with each one of your products. With us, you go into your Umari dashboard, you see every single one of your products, and you can see what the status is of each one of those products. So you can see if you have a couple in product development, a couple in sampling, a couple in production, some are already in transit, and what is already in your warehouse. We tell you when you should be sourcing again, when you should be starting to create a product development for a new line. We give you all that info so you can always be, keep running, keep your brand running.
Wow, this is actually very exciting. I just remembered, actually, off the top of my head, that you're actually the number 3 Mexican I've had on my call now, on my podcast now. And okay. The reason I remembered that is because the second Mexicano that I had on my podcast was someone who was helping foreign brands to sell into Mexico via Amazon Mexico. So he's working on building a company that brings the goods in and gets them distributed within Mexico. And you're obviously helping to get goods distributed out from Mexico. And so it's an exciting space to be. And the first Mexicano I ever had on the call was working with effectively an internal business entrepreneurial incubator platform provider and service provider. So it really feels like we're attacking this digitally from so many different angles.
Yeah, I love it. Who was that? Solving gun and problem.
What I'll do is I'll make an intro between the three of you.
Yeah,
because sure. I think that I think, look, I want to help facilitate these conversations, and I'm really excited about the transformative power of digital. So when we think about what you guys do today, how much of that is digitally surfaced today, and what is your ultimate vision for how these services get provided? Is it ultimately your vision to where I could completely engage with Umari through your web platform? I could submit my tech pack. I could, through your, say, for example, suite of APIs or through the UI, I could upload my tech pack. I could request quotes. I could say what my quantities are. I could say where the destination needs to go to or whatever it might be. I could get a quote for all the logistics capabilities I need, transship under bond, whatever it might be. Is it your vision ultimately that almost everything you do today that has the human element can be automated through a digital and e-commerce interface? Is that the vision?
That is 100%, because we actually, on purpose, we haven't grown the team, because if we need to hire more people to do what we're doing right now, we're not doing it right. This needs to be done by technology. And we're not key account managers at a sourcing company. We are not a brokerage company. We are a digital platform. And so you are supposed to be able to go into our platform, create a request for quotation, and have go through the process completely through the platform and have the platform solve all of those issues. All of the information is out there. We just need to digitize it. We just need to standardize the way that this process happens. But the process of creating a new garment is pretty straightforward. If you want to make a hoodie, I'll give you the options. So you can actually just click your weight through the creation of your hoodie. I can tell you we got 240 GSM, 300 GSM, 340, 380, 400. We have 50-50 fleece. We have 80-20 polyester cotton. We have 100% French dairy, right? So you can actually just go your like click your weights in the process of creating. And in options, we have about 3,000 different hoodies that you could actually make. But the process is, goes and starts bundling your options until you get a product finalized. That can be translated into a Spanish duck bag that gets published into our factories. Then they present their quotations to the platform, selects the best one, forwards to the buyer, and then we can do the rest of the production also through the platform. So every single part of the creation of follow-up until the product is in your warehouse can and should be done through the platform.
Absolutely love that. Payments, all of the back and forth throughout the production process, the tech packs, the PLM integration, that whole thing. I feel like that can all be done digitally, which is amazing. I've had a few clients working in the apparel and footwear space. So I'm a little bit familiar with some of these processes already, it's a very exciting space. Now, when we think about the next verticals that you want to become expert in, because each vertical has its own unique complexities, it's got its own attributes, it's got its own everything. It's really got its own everything. And I feel like one of the things that perhaps is the heavy lift that you provide. Sure, you offer all of these back-end services, but I feel like the translation services are perhaps one of the most important value adds that you bring to the table. It's okay, a lot of these manufacturers, and I was even somewhat surprised when I first moved here. I shouldn't have been, but I was a little bit surprised that English outside of the tourist areas, English is not a thing. It's just not a thing inside Mexico. And so you can be in huge parts of Puebla, huge parts of Mexico City, where, you know, English is just, it's just not spoken. And if you can't speak at least conversational Spanish, you are going to bloody struggle. It's just that simple. And I think people come to Mexico sometimes with the mistaken idea that English is widely spoken here, and it's just not. And so I would imagine that especially in the blue collar manufacturing industries, that English is even less common, except for perhaps the owners of the business that maybe are international business people or whatever. But English is just not going to be the language that is spoken on the factory floor. And as a result of that, it feels like the translation capability that you have is a massive value add.
It is massive value. You cannot send an English tech back to factories in Mexico and have them and expect for them to create a product out of that. It's just not going to happen. Yeah, we 100%. We saw that from the beginning, and we're like, that is going to be one of the most important things in order to be able to streamline this, because we need to be able to be just as fast as the Chinese are, and they are good at what they do, but language is a problem. It is an issue, and so that was one of the first things that we wanted to solve.
And what's the next verticals you want to attack after apparel?
We're going to do on home decor, where we have furniture. So furniture is, I think, a huge opportunity for the Mexican
market. My God, I see in Muebles so everywhere here. It's the amount of furniture stores in this country is frankly overwhelming, especially in Guadalajara. It's phenomenal.
Yep, exactly. So Guadalajara, Torreón. So we have a couple of Chihuahua, has a couple of furniture producing areas. So we are quite good, very competitive. And just think about moving heavy furniture from Asia into the US, that's expensive. And so bringing it off from Mexico is it's a much easier thing to do. The planning of your sales cycles is just so much easier when you do it from Mexico. So we're moving into furniture. And then after furniture, we'll be doing beauty and healthcare. Mexico and Colombia are the third and sixth largest exporters of beauty and healthcare, hair, skincare, and makeup. And beauty, food and beverage is also our next vertical. And then we have school and office supplies. And the last one, the last that we'll be tackling will be agro something. It's a dream of mine. I'd love to go and fix a lot of things that are happening in that space, but it is a whole nother world. In terms of transactions, in terms of expectations, in terms of spec sheets.
What other countries in LATAM, or are you just really pretty much laser focused on Mexico for now? And then once you get to scale, then you'll be looking at the rest of wider LATAM? Or is this, you're attacking this on all fronts, LATAM wide?
We are already doing things in Colombia and Peru. So we're already working. I used to work very closely with ProColombia and ProPeru. So we're already working with Colombian suppliers and Peruvian suppliers. Peruvians are great for cotton, for example. Colombians are great for fashion and for compression, swimwear, nylon, polyester. We're doing cottons in Peru, and we're doing a lot of the other, like you're all in Mexico. We have been taking into account what every country is specially doing, and what that's what we offer our clients.
So are you facilitating bi-directional transactions across your B2B merchants, or is it really just from manufacturer to brand?
We're already doing it.
I'm excited to see where this goes, you know, especially given that you are so driven, you are so experienced, and you're so young. I don't mean you physically young, although you look incredibly young as well, but you've only been at this for just over a year. And it sounds like you've accomplished quite a lot. So you're clearly very driven. If we were to look out over the next 12 to 18 months, what are your priorities? Obviously, looking out into the future, it's unlimited. But if we were to look in the near future, what is the top priorities for you as part of building this new B2B platform?
We've been dreaming. We knew from the beginning that we were trying to do something that was big. And that's been the idea from the beginning, since the moment we created this. Right now I'm taking it a vertical at a time. So our goals are very specific. We want to reach $1 million in monthly GMV by the summer. $1 million plus GMV by the summer would allow us to raise the next round. We raised a pre-seed round of $2 million. So we would be raising about $3-4 million just to be able to expand to the next verticals, to be fast and doing what technology is, I was saying before. And I think that would allow us, I really would just want to build something that lasts a long time. The idea I had so I could make a startup, because I wanted to be a startup founder. This is what I've been working on my whole life. This is what I've been doing, what I've been like breathing and thinking about my whole life.
I'm going to do everything in my power to support you in that. I'm going to connect you up with my other Mexican friends who are in the industry and hopefully create a little bit of a mini ecosystem here just within my network of Mexicanos looking to move the needle significantly in this country. Because I think I'm excited. I've been looking at some of the demographic statistics of Mexico. I've been looking at the demographics of the working population in Mexico are phenomenal. Like they're on average, I think the working age in Mexico, I think on average is about 10 years younger than in the United States, most Western countries. It's a young, dynamic, hungry population in this country looking to achieve and looking to do great things and looking to be entrepreneurial. And I think that Mexico, I think to a degree, has perhaps been underappreciated in terms of its output prowess and its ability to scale manufacturing. Because of course, China dominated the discussion for so many years that it drowned out almost everybody else. But I feel like there's a lot of unsung heroes in the manufacturing space in this country that deserve to be put on a pedestal and deserve to have their wares exported to the world. And it feels like you're going to play a very big part in that. So I'm pumped. I'm really excited for you. I think you're doing something really amazing, and you're working to help Mexicans, Mexicanos all over this country to better their lives and to build their communities. Because I tell you, for a lot of these manufacturing facilities, they're not employing 1, 2, 3, 4 people. They're employing 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100, 200 people in these factories. And this materially impacts these people's lives when they get into manufacturing. Andreas, this has been a fantastic chat. We're coming down to the end of our time together, and this is where I like to turn the microphone over to my guest. Let them ask me one question. Any question they like can be personal or professional. So, Andreas, from you, Mari, what is your question for me today?
Jason, do you think Mexicans are
trustworthy? I think they absolutely are. I think that
do you think Mexicans
you
are
have to not be a soft target in Mexico at the same time. I think that like many other countries, if you make yourself a soft target and you open yourself up to be taken advantage of, it's pretty easy to take advantage of people from a business perspective in this country, because there's just not the same level of regulation. There's not, let's just take real estate as one small example. Because I'm looking at potentially buying real estate here, and it's a minefield. I've already bought a car here, and that was a minefield. I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen any other country in the world where it's so difficult to buy a vehicle and not get ripped off. So I would say that if you come in and you've got that typical gringo attitude where you're going to swing your weight around and you're going to flash the cash and it's going to open doors for you, you are opening yourself up to be taken advantage of because you're stupid, not because Mexicans are necessarily out to take advantage of you, just because you're dumb. And so I would say, don't come in and think that you're going to be able to change things, because Mexico's Mexico, and that's the way that it is. You have to figure out how Mexico works, not the other way around. Mexico is not there to accommodate you. You have to fit in. You have to blend in. You have to integrate in with the culture. And so that's why when I went to buy my car in Mexico City, I took a Mexicano with me because I knew it's going to be easy. It's going to be easy for me to get ripped off. And it's the same thing with real estate. It's easy for you to get ripped off if you don't know the process and you don't have a trustworthy notario to guide you through the process and make sure the title transfer happens, et cetera, and that it's not a Hito land without you knowing it, for example. There's just, it's a minefield, not so much because Mexicans might try to rip you off, but just because if you're ignorant, it bites you harder. Ignorance bites you harder in Mexico than it does almost anywhere else I've ever seen. And so you just can't come in and be an idiot in this country, because they will work within the system to extract the maximum amount of value out of the system as they can. And if they know how to work the system and you don't, you're going to get shafted. It's that simple.
I get it. I do. No, it's true. It is a country where you have to like always be aware of possibilities and the risks. But yeah, no, it's just because I feel like there's still a lot of companies that would be like, oh, I'm not sure. Like, I've been working with my Chinese suppliers for 25 years. I don't know if I can just trust that I can do things in Mexico. And I always try to find, what is it that Americans mostly fear about exploring Mexico as an option for having manufacturing partners? But yeah, no, I'm convinced that at the end of the day, we deliver in time the product that we promised, and we have our competitive prices. The companies will start trusting that Mexico is just the trade partner that we've been waiting for a long time. I am that friend. I am that friend that you bring along to make sure that no one gets screwed over. LinkedIn really works perfectly. I check my LinkedIn every single day. Andres@imari.io. That's my email. And anyone who wants to talk about cross-border from Mexico or Latin America, love to talk about that. Thank you, Deez, and have a good day.
Are you a B2B or D2C e-commerce merchant? Then head over to greenwoodconsulting.net to learn how we can help you scale your business.